This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. A new United Nations-backed report highlights the massive destruction caused by invasive species on a global scale. The report was published by the Intergovernmental Science Policy Platform on Biodiversity and Ecosystem Services. It looked at over 3,500 invasive species across the world. It estimates that invasive species cost society $423 billion every year. Invasive species also cause about 60% of extinctions. They're so widespread, they've even made it to Antarctica, where invasive grasses have been introduced. Our next guests are experts on invasive species here in Wisconsin and beyond. You could join in at 800-642-1234. Do you run into some invasive species in Wisconsin? Are you battling one of them maybe on your own property? Or do you have questions about the impact here in the state and elsewhere? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Brad Herrick is an ecologist and research program manager at the University of Wisconsin-Madison Arboretum. Brad, welcome back to Central Time.
Thanks, Rob. Nice to be here.
Also with us, Carol Lee, professor in the Department of Integrative Biology at UW-Madison. She served as an advisor on invasive species and climate change to the National Science Foundation. Carol, thanks for being with us.
Thanks a lot for inviting me. It's a pleasure to be here.
We've got this big international report. Carol, can you help us understand the scale of the invasive species problem?
Well, the scale is enormous. As the report says, invasive populations are causing huge economic costs. For example, according to the World Health Organization's Guide to Ship Sanitation, about 10 billion metric tons of ballast water are transported through ship traffic every year. This is incredibly costly. I work on aquatic invasions, and the scale is just incredibly enormous. We're talking about billions and billions of tons of water moved throughout the year, causing large numbers of invasive populations to enter novel habitats. That's just one example.
Brad, people might wonder, you know, species have moved around through the millennia, you know, it moving into new environments all the time. Why are things different now? What is it about our current invasive species situation that makes it so easy to throw things out of whack?
Right. That's a good point. And, you know, we're in a time of globalization where it's very easy to move around the world. And, you know, at times we either on purpose or inadvertently move species with us. And they're moving in ways that they would never be able to move on their own. So crossing oceans and, like you mentioned, grasses getting to the Arctic. And so the scale is much larger and happening much quicker than it would just, you know, in a natural way.
Carol, Brad mentioned sometimes intentionally spread things like horticulture, exotic pets also contribute to the problem. I believe we used to plant purple loosestrife, for example, in Wisconsin.
Yes.
On purpose. We don't do that
Yes.
anymore, I hope. How big a part
Right.
of the story is that?
That's a huge part. I think the horticulture industry, the pet industry, the aquarium industry are pretty large contributors. So the biggest factor that correlates with the rate of invasions is our trade volume in general, shipping trade, cargo trade, et cetera. But definitely the garden, I think we need to fundamentally change how we garden and plant native species. So the horticulture industry, the pet industry, the aquarium industry, people releasing invasive plants in their gardens, releasing aquarium fish into lakes, such as the African cichlids in Florida. These are definitely contributors to the larger problem.
And Brad, I mentioned invasive species often contribute to the extinction of other species. How big a problem is that?
That's a major problem, and this report definitely highlights that. And it's not only, you know, a single or even multiple invasive organisms that can displace native species. It's multiple stressors. So we have the stress of climate change and, you know, fragmentation and pollution. And then you couple that with the introduction of a brand new species that does not have predators, for instance, and is able to outcompete native species. And all these multiple stressors, like this report illustrates, have really serious consequences for biodiversity.
Talking to Brad Herrick with UW-Madison Arboretum and Carol Lee, professor in the Department of Integrative Biology at UW-Madison, looking at invasive species. A new United Nations-backed report puts a huge multi-billion-dollar annual price tag on them. You could join in with your thoughts, your questions, maybe your experiences with an invasive species in your own backyard. Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Carol, the report named the most widespread invasive animal in the world, the black rat, the most widespread invasive plant in the world, the water hyacinth. What is it, and Brad started to touch on this, what is it that makes some species so successful when they're introduced to a new and different environment?
Yeah, that's an excellent question. This is multifaceted. There's usually not just one factor, but multiple factors. So there are extrinsic factors like the environmental conditions that enable them to invade, and also intrinsic properties, such as the traits that a population might have or an individual organism might have, or their genetic composition, such as how much genetic variation there is in the population. So if there's sufficient genetic variation, if there's something about the novel habitat, like lack of predators, lack of competitors, those are factors that would contribute. So there's multiple factors that enable a population to become invasive. One thing I want to emphasize is that not all introduced populations become invasive. There's a subset that do, and that subset tends to be either really good at spreading or they're really good at evolving to adapt to novel conditions. So there's a series of different factors involved.
Brad, you've been on the show in the past talking about one invasive species we have here in Wisconsin, a kind of jumping worm. Can you tell us a little bit about the history and impact?
Right. So this is a relatively new invader to North America, at least in terms of its spread. It was introduced a while ago into a couple of different states, but the last 15, 20 years, it's really spread. And the Arboretum here on campus at the University of Wisconsin was the first record in the state of this invasive earthworm. And basically the concern is that these earthworms, like all earthworms do, they consume vast amounts of organic matter. So whether that's leaves that have fallen on the forest floor or compost and mulch that you put down on your garden, they consume it so rapidly that it depletes nutrients that are really important for plant growth. It causes soil erosion because there's nothing able to hold the soil in place in terms of the plant roots. And we're seeing now they're spreading throughout the United States, into Canada, they're in Mexico. And so they are, in some sense, a generalist invader, invading multiple climates and habitats. And so it's one that is relatively new, and it follows a previous earthworm invasion. And some people don't appreciate that in Wisconsin and upper Midwest, all earthworms are non-native. And many of them are invasive. So like the common nightcrawler, one that's very popular with fishing and gardening, is considered invasive. And so we have sort of a second wave now of earthworms coming in that are really fundamentally different from that first wave. And so we're just sort of catching up now in terms of research, learning about the potential impacts.
And Carol, what species in our waterways do you have your eyes on?
Well, my laboratory has worked on zebra mussels, quagga mussels, and invasive plankton. So one thing that people often don't think about is with ballast water dumping, tons and tons and tons of planktonic species are being dumped into the waterways. So I'm interested in a lot of those crustacean plankton species that are also being introduced in massive scales. So Great Lakes invasions is especially what I'm interested in. I'm also looking at invaders in Europe and invaders all over the world, but mainly aquatic invaders is what I have my eyes on.
And how do those zebra mussels and others, and we've talked about them on the show before, what kind of impact are they having on our freshwater waterways in the state?
Well, you can probably see them. Anyone who's gone to the shoreline can see them taking over. they not only they're filter suspension feeders, so they eat up all the plankton, planktonic algae that are in the water, making them unavailable for other species. So the water might look clean, but they're also taking out a lot of the food from the waterways that other populations or species might want to consume. They're also displacing a lot of native mussels, like uniodon mussels, which are slower growing. They're also encrusting any physical structure. So they're physically altering the habitat by growing over anything. So without an abundance of natural predators, they're just kind of taking over in terms of population growth. So the zebra mussels invaded first, and now the quagga mussels are taking over. And that's a common pattern that's also happening in Europe and in other locations. Usually the zebra mussel is a faster invader. Ultimately, the quagga mussel takes over and becomes more of a problem in the long run.
We're talking about a new United Nations-backed report on the global impact of invasive species. Carol Lee is with us, professor in the Department of Integrative Biology at UW-Madison, and Brad Herrick is an ecologist and research program manager at the UW-Madison Arboretum. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Coming up, solutions, possible solutions. What do you want to see done to address the invasive species problem globally and maybe in your own backyard? Do you think non-native plant and animal species need more controls on them? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. We'll pick up the conversation coming up here on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up our talk with Carol Lee, professor in the Department of Integrative Biology at UW-Madison, and Brad Herrick, ecologist and research program manager at the UW-Madison Arboretum, looking at a new report finding that invasive species cost over $400 billion globally each year and cause massive environmental destruction. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Let's go to your calls now. Mary is with us in Milwaukee. Mary, hi.
Hi, how are you all doing?
Good. What do you want to ask about?
Well, I have sort of a question, but I guess I'm asking more for comments or information from the guests. Where invasive species are considered, I'm wondering about the definition and whether there's an expiration date on that. And I'll give you the example that's bringing this to mind for me. I have heard for a good while and heard repeated again Australian dingoes called an invasive species. And there have been in my lifetime, and I'm not that old, plenty of initiatives where thousands upon thousands of dingoes were hunted down and killed in Australia. I think of that animal as being pretty quintessentially Australian, and it turns out there's pretty good reason for that. They've been there for thousands of years.
Mary, I gotcha. Carol, is there a definition where we might say, okay, it wasn't there originally, maybe it came over with humans, as I believe the dingo did in Australia, but after a few millennia, it gets to count as part of the local landscape?
Well, I think we need to think about the context for invasive populations. It is true that some populations become naturalized. For instance, if you look at the work of Bern Blossi at Cornell University, the garlic mustard on the East Coast has been there a lot longer than in the Midwest. So garlic mustard is highly invasive in the Midwest, but on the East Coast, it's becoming naturalized. Over decades, it has evolved to become less invasive. And the natural populations, the competitors, have evolved to be able to compete with the garlic mustard. So there is an evolutionary context. So over time, an invasive population can become naturalized if we let the native populations evolve, either to prey upon the species, native pathogens to infect this invader, or native species to compete with them. So there is some kind of, as the caller said, expiration date when they're no longer invasive. But this is a long time period. And we do need, when the invader comes in, we do need to protect the native species so that they could evolve in response to the invader and not get extirpated, not go extinct.
Mary.
I'm wondering if that answers the question.
Sure. Mary, thanks a lot for that call. Before we go back to our callers, Brad, I want to start to touch on some solutions. When we have a species like, say, a jumping worm, what are some of the things we either maybe could have done to prevent it showing up or to turn it back once it's here?
Well, in terms of most invasive species, it like Carol alluded to, it really depends on the context. It depends on, you know, how early an invasive species is identified and if there are controls that are readily available. You know, the first thing when it comes to, you know, whether it's jumping worms or any invasive species, is education. It really, and, you know, having folks understand what the species looks like, what it is, where to find it, what its potential impacts are, and really, explaining why it's potentially problematic that we have these species. And then you sort of gain trust and you get some buy-in into helping to control. Prevention is, like in the medical industry, prevention is the best medicine when it comes to invasive species. It's by far the most cost-effective. There are, depending on the species and the context, there are, you know, some technologies that are being developed to, deal with some invasive species. There are controls, depending on the context, but those are really labor intensive often and sometimes cost prohibitive. And so, prevention, education, slowing the spread, that's really where it starts.
Let's go back to our callers. Yes. Mark is with us in Two Rivers. Mark, hi.
Hi, thank you for taking my call. In my previous employer and where I work now, we've gone through some quite extreme measures for controlling quagga mussels and zebra mussels, namely through chemical injection. And at my previous employer, it kind of came on to us rather rapidly. And before we realized, by the time we realized we had a zebra mussel problem, they were already causing some pretty catastrophic consequences in our cooling water systems at my employer. And that's what I wanted to bring up.
Mark, thanks a lot for that call. And Carol, that goes, I think, right to your interest there. Once we have zebra mussels and quagga mussels, what can we do about them?
That's a really difficult problem. There's many different methods that have been proposed, like chemical methods, mechanical removal, thermal treatment, UV light, low frequency magnetism. Somebody also wanted to introduce bacteria. There was a scientist that called me once. He wanted to look at the experiments I was doing and wanted to test using a pathogen bacteria. And I was not particularly keen on that because we don't know what effect that pathogen would have on other Great Lakes species. There's people that want to introduce serotonin to affect the physiology of the organisms. I think there are a variety of methods that are proposed. I do think that it is important to clamp down on them to reduce their numbers so that the native populations can survive and eventually evolve in response to them. I do think we need to be careful about some of the solutions and methods because that can introduce a whole nother can of worms. For instance, introducing a pathogen could kill off other native populations. Introducing chemicals could also be problematic. So I think very rigorous testing is required. There are a variety of methods out there. I like the mechanical method, but we do need to reduce their numbers to allow some native populations, native species to survive and not go extinct. We do need to be careful about the methods we're using and think carefully about their consequences.
I want to ask each of you, thanks again for that call, Mark. I want to ask each of you for maybe a couple items from your wish list, policy changes you might like to see made that would help prevent the spread of invasive species and help support the native species. Brad, let's start with you.
That's a big question.
Yes.
I think it starts with federal funding to really be able to inspect the borders in a way that can clamp down on some, especially some of these newer ones, or newer invasive species. So it, and even at the state level, we have a great Department of Natural Resources that have regulations in place for invasive species, but very little enforcement ability, just given the scale. And so funding to come up with education, prevention ideas, new technologies, but really at the border, preventing the introduction of new species. So we have our hands full with the ones that are already here.
And Carol, if I could zoom in on one you're working on, I believe in your own yard. You think we could have some policies that might help our native plant species in particular?
Yes, I have a pretty long wish list, but I'm only going to name a few things. I think we really need to regulate, and some people hate the word regulation, but we really need to regulate the horticulture and aquarium industries. For instance, you could go online and order the worst invader in our local habitat and plant it in your yard. And our own gardens are a huge source of novel invaders. So we need to fundamentally rethink and change how we garden, as I mentioned earlier. And we should encourage the planting of native species. For instance, our highways. When I was living in California, they were planting invasive Australian ice plants along the highway, one of the terrible invaders there. So even our government systems, our institutions should be encouraged to plant native species. I mean, and we should fundamentally rethink what we think is beautiful. Why is the Kentucky invasive bluegrass the default beautiful thing that we plant in our lawns? Why are we planting invasive species, all these lawn plants, when we could actually regard our native prairies as beautiful, which will support native insects and other native populations? So we need to rethink what we consider beautiful and really promote our native populations. And we need to let areas go wild. Disturbance is something that promotes invasive populations to enter new habitats. Instead of, you know, constantly turning over and disturbing habitats, we should let certain areas just, you know, go wild and leave.
And we'll leave it there. Thanks to our guests, Carol Lee and Brad Herrick, with us for a look at invasive species in Wisconsin and beyond. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Barrett. Now, the Biden administration has continued tariffs on Chinese imports that were put in place by the Trump administration. U.S. Commerce Secretary Gina Raimondo said this week that the U.S. Trade Representative's office is reviewing those tariffs to evaluate their effectiveness, but that the White House has no plans to change them at this time. The continuing tariffs on China are just one example of where President Biden has taken a different approach on trade compared to the Obama and Clinton administrations. Biden has also shied away from striking new trade deals and invested more in domestic manufacturing, energy, and infrastructure compared to previous Democratic administrations that leaned more on international commerce. We're learning more about how U.S. trade policy has shifted over time and how that could shape debate over the economy heading into the 2024 election. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What do you think of the way Biden has handled trade policy? Do you want to see tariffs on China remain in place? How do you feel about the investments in manufacturing and infrastructure? How about things like supporting microchip manufacturing here in the country, trying to lower dependence on foreign sources? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Avik Chakravarti is an associate professor of economics at UW-Milwaukee, where he researches international trade and finance. He's a faculty affiliate at the Northwestern Mutual Data Science Institute. Avik, welcome back to Central Time.
Thank you.
Big picture, Avik, how do you look at the Biden administration, how it's approached trade policy? What has struck you over the last couple of years?
Well, like you said, I think every listener of yours, as well as those who are eager to see the America First agenda that President Trump had put in place, we see some very encouraging trends in the current administration that has definitely distinctively deviated from what we had seen before President Trump. And the idea is the only way that a country can be put first, a country as prospers as the United States is by making sure that other countries do not take advantage of it. So I think that what President Trump had put forward is an agenda that's coming to fruition. And I think that irrespective of any political outcome, President Trump's initiatives will show over time to be very, very effective. And I think that, future presidents from either party will have to embrace it, like we see President Biden embracing it during his first term.
Yeah, President Trump talked more, I think, and more loudly about his changes to trade policy. Have you seen much change, though, from the Trump to Biden administrations on this issue, on things like tariffs and protectionism?
What we have seen in terms of changes, if we look through a microscope, if you will, is most recently, if you look at just before the political trips to China, if you look at the economics of it, you notice that some key sectors like technological sectors are going to be affected even more than before through President Biden's executive order. And the only distinction you see is in terms of focus on sectors. For example, if you look at computing chips or quantum technology as a broader term, or artificial intelligence, microelectronics, these are places where we are seeing greater emphasis, more targeted emphasis. However, that said, though, I have to say that when President Trump talked about all of these in the aggregate, it was the earliest credible signal being sent to our then largest trading partner, now probably in the third place after Mexico and Canada, which is China now, which has recently been ranked third rather than first. But overall, the idea that President Trump put forward through his dialogues and efforts to diplomatically resolve the disputes with China were very much in line with what we are seeing today, with even more focused, even more forceful forceful impositions of restrictions. And my prediction during President Trump's tenure was that had he been in office today, we would have seen similar, if not stronger, restrictions on China.
Talking to Avik Chakrabarty from UW-Milwaukee, Associate Professor of Economics there, looking at U.S. trade policy. Some common themes in the Trump and Biden administration's departures from what we had seen from Democrats and Republicans in the years before that. You can join in with your thoughts, your questions at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Avik, I think there was a consensus maybe before the 2016 election. There's a debate between the idea of, okay, we want free trade that might hurt some American manufacturing, but it'll bring benefits to consumers in terms of cheaper goods, versus no, the priority should be protecting American manufacturing. Leading Democrats and Republicans went for that free trade formula. Now we saw Bernie Sanders and Donald Trump in 2016 arguing against it. Now Biden, as you suggest, joining them. What do you think led people to move in that direction?
See, we always needed a very effective leader like President Trump to come in and make it clear to the public that the United States was being taken advantage by other countries in various forms, including countries in Europe. So we shouldn't single out China, but the point is that economically speaking, on the trade platform, China, whether we strongly use the word taking advantage or they were simply pushing their Make China Great agenda, but President Trump brought back Make America Great Again in the sense that somehow the leaders in this country at various levels, local all the way up to the national levels, were apparently becoming oblivious of the fact that there were trade agreements with other countries, including this Section 301 that President Trump boldly brought back into our limelight, is that many, many aspects of this Trade Act of 1974. So this goes back so many decades. Like we're talking about an era where many of our listeners may not even been interested in economics and politics. But in 1974, we had this agreement which was greatly violated by many countries. And the reason China comes to limelight is because China became the largest trading partner with the United States, and we had the largest trade deficit. So the question was, how can we reduce our dependence on one country, diversify our trade, but most importantly, level the playing field. And without President Trump's bringing this into the limelight, I think that we would still be wondering why were there such strict tariffs, such sudden imposition of restrictions on a single country like China. Why was it important? And this is the importance of it, that we need to level the playing fields if we want free trade like those who saw before President Trump. We also need fair trade. We need other countries to free up their trade too, if they want to freely trade with us. That's pretty much the message that President Trump sent, and I think that any administration, including the current, would continue to send in the near future.
There were concerns during the Trump administration about retaliation. So, you know, some farmers here in Wisconsin may have had less favorable opportunities to sell to China than they had previously. The idea that, you know, we were escalating a trade war, in effect, that was hurting all sides. Did you see some of that happening?
Absolutely. Absolutely. And see, this is why having an economically highly sophisticated mind in the White House was important. So while we saw President Trump as our political leader, we also saw an economic mind at work. So it was difficult to fool President Trump through Washington politics. So he understood that there would be retaliation, because it's impossible to not have retaliation from the world's soon to become maybe the largest economy in the world, surpassing us, China, not population-wise, of course, but population-wise, India is the largest economic democracy that you can imagine. But in terms of economic power, you have China, right? They're competing neck to neck with the United States, and retaliation was definitely anticipated. So what President Trump did was he essentially said, okay, fine. I mean, if you hurt our farmers, we will subsidize our farmers using the tariff money, the revenue that we have through these tax impositions, which are called tariffs in international economics. No difference between tariffs and taxes. It's just on foreign producers. And once you take the money from foreign producers, give it to our farmers, that indicate that signals to foreign countries that you keep doing it. If you retaliate, we will be doing enough to help our segments of the population that are being hurt. At the same time, we want to keep in mind that President Trump also clearly saw that because we import so much more from China, like if you think about even modified figures, we are looking at almost four times the amount of values of imports that were hurt by tariffs by President Trump's initiative on China, whereas China could only retaliate by imposing tariffs to the extent of a couple of hundred billion or shy of that. We had more than $550 billion worth of goods from China that were being affected. So China was going to be affected by more because it would soon run out of options to impose retaliations on us. And that's clearly because we were running such a large deficit with China. So I think all of these went into the calculation when President Trump went ahead and initiated this signal, if you will, which the Biden administration is carrying through till date, with small reversals. You know, if you notice, there's been a little bit of softening in the tone with the three visits to China, one political visit, one military visit, and one most recent economic visit. That we think we are trying to soften a little bit, but softening will be effective only if the trading partners, including China, softens their stance as well.
We're talking to UW-Milwaukee economics professor Avik Chakrabarty about how the Biden administration has handled trade policy, how that compares to President Trump and other predecessors. You can join in at 800-642-1234. How do you think about President Biden's approach to trade, former President Trump's approach to trade? What would you like to see the White House focus on? Join in at 800-642-1234. Does this affect your livelihood one way or another? 800-642-1234. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Barrett. We continue our talk with Avik Chakrabarty, Associate Professor of Economics at UW-Milwaukee, who researches international trade and finance, with us today to look at White House policy on trade, tariffs, China, and domestic investment. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What's more important to you? Free trade, maybe allowing cheaper consumer goods into the country, or boosting American industry, manufacturing, agriculture? Join in at 800-642-1234. Let's bring on a caller. Nate is with us in Milwaukee. Nate, hello.
Hi, thank you for having me. It sounds like what Biden did is took some of the parts of the Trump policies that were working out and kept them, and then actually took, in addition to that, care of some issues that Trump wasn't dealing with or was dealing with in a terrible way. I'll say that one of the failures I feel of the Trump administration is that he never put a carbon tariff on China, because China actually puts out more carbon dioxide than the U.S. in terms of global warming. And Biden has not done that, but he has tried to deal with global warming when dealing with other countries. And he's also encouraged domestic investment so that if we can get our economy to change in time enough, we can avoid some of the worst impacts of global warming. Additionally, I think that Biden just has a better foreign policy in that NATO is still intact, and if Trump was given a second term, that is very much in question.
Nate, thanks for the call. Avik, I want to zoom in on Nate's idea using trade policy as a tool, a stick, I think, to get other countries to help fight climate change. What do you think of that idea?
Absolutely. That's a very useful idea. But at the same time, I listened to what Nate said, and I, like many who would agree with Nate, that the environment is something for us to protect, not only for us, but for generations to come. And while Nate may not have followed that during Trump administration and during even before President Trump's administration, during Trump, President Trump's administration, and carrying on to President Biden's administration, there is always an overarching concern about the environment. The question is, to what extent do we push the environmental agenda so that we are not hurt immediately without being prepared? For example, take the energy crisis, right? Any intelligent economist or strategist would say that we were not prepared for the energy situation that we're in now. So trying to say that we're saving the environment, but then putting more pain, which we did not even take into account, would be not so prudent policy. So I think that the environmental agenda is absolutely justified. It's a long-run perspective we need to take, because remember that the environment was degraded not by one president, but by many presidents in the past, if you want to blame any president. So when President Trump came in, he was trying to protect our energy sector, where we were trying to become not only self-sufficient, but sometimes to the extent exporting to other nations. This was important not only to make our country more resilient, but also to reduce any kind of dependency that might cause more harm to us, particularly in the strategic sectors. So I agree with Nate that environment is important, and I agree with the components of Biden and President Biden's policies that are protecting the environment. And I think it's in line with President Trump's work as well.
Nate, thanks for the call. Avik, I wanted to get into the Trans-Pacific Partnership. There's this idea, again, criticized by then 2016 presidential candidate Bernie Sanders and then candidate Donald Trump, very opposed to the TPP, the Trans-Pacific Partnership. One of the hopes of supporters was, hey, it's going to bring the United States together and Pacific powers against China in some ways, as a competitor to China. Is there a value in doing some kind of arrangement like that gives the U.S. and its allies advantages over China as an economic competitor?
Yes, yes. In fact, going back to your reference to President Trump's position on TPP, the Trans-Pacific Agreement Partnership in particular, essentially what President Trump was trying to do is trying to diversify our dependence on other countries. Because when you are dependent on one country like China or Canada or Mexico at one time, it makes us more vulnerable. So the idea is to diversify as much as possible. And the country that President Trump had in mind, very rightfully so, was India. Because if you look at India and make a comparison with China, India is the largest populous economic democracy that you can see on the face of Earth. So there is, and the young democracy. So if you look at the age composition of Indian population, it's more productive, it's more young. So bringing in India into the picture without having a broader net was the initiative that President Trump took. I remember Prime Minister Modi, president here is most powerful. The prime minister in India is most powerful. So Prime Minister Modi visited the United States, and there were very good relationships that were being built. And that's been continued over time through this current administration. And like I said, irrespective of political changes, I think that this type of an expansion of relationship between United States and other Asian economies, or trans-Pacific economies, if you will, without needing any new contracts or agreements in place, would be highly welcome. So I think the idea is to replace one country or three countries, like, you know, Canada, Mexico, and China, instead of replacing them entirely, just diversify competition, extending hopefully to at least India, which holds a lot of promise for the rest of the world in generations to come.
Time for one more caller. Willem is with us in Colfax. Willem, hi.
Hi. I think, you know, you've been praising the Trump administration quite a bit for their economic policies and what a positive effect they have had on America. But a really negative effect on America and his policies was the calling of climate change a hoax, and that ceding that sort of industry to other countries like Denmark and China. And, you know, basically this other policy of including more countries is basically these countries are used for cheap labor. So we have a poorer working class that can afford cheap products from China and India and other nations.
Willem, thanks for the call. Which part of that do you want to tackle, Avik? We just have a minute or so left.
Yeah, sure. And let me give me a little raise a flag if I'm going over time. But the way to respond positively to your question, to your caller's question, is to say, look, it takes some time to adjust. So that's my point. So President Trump called the environmental agenda hoax to the extent that it was done without us being prepared to deal with it. So it's one thing to say that he completely was not interested in environment. That is absolutely not true. He did want the environment to become cleaner for...
But climate change, he did flat out call it a hoax, a Chinese
exactly.
hoax in some cases.
Yeah, I mean, see, keep in mind that the president of the United States cannot be blamed for everything, but we tend to do that. But what's unfortunately, but essentially what President Trump was trying to do when he called it a hoax is he intended to say that it's being misused by people to reduce the self-sufficiency of certain sectors in the United States. So while the environment needs to be clean and the climate change has to be brought about, but it should not be turned into a hoax, that's what he meant, to promote certain agenda that are not beneficial to our generation or the future. So I think that, you know, bringing in more countries, the other part of the question, which may have vices, for example, your caller mentioned, like poor lay workers, child workers, of course, those are humanitarian grounds on which we have to be careful. But we need to keep in mind that the reason that people are poor in other countries is because they don't have an option to earn more. So if we trade more with them, they will earn more. They will send less of their children to work and send them to school. So trade is a way of reaching out to countries which are in need for assistance, not foreign aid, but essentially kind of getting into a situation where we can continue to be the leader of the free world.
And we'll leave it there. Thanks to our guest, Avik Chakrabarty, Associate Professor of Economics at UW-Milwaukee, where he researches international trade and finance. Coming up tomorrow on Central Time, a bill in the state legislature aims to boost access to breast cancer screenings. We'll hear from two of the sponsors and a breast cancer survivor who's making the case for that change. That and more tomorrow on Central Time.